Good morning. On today's programme, human rights concerns over the jailing of a Tunisian graffiti artist and how Cyprus is impacted by the Israel-Hamas war. But first we go to the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Fighting between the M23 rebels and government forces has intensified in the country in a conflict that has been raging since 2021. But in the past several weeks, the rebels have begun to advance on a regional capital, Goma, leading to tens of thousands of frightened people being forced out of their homes to flee for safety. From Goma, Emmett Livingston reports.
This week, thousands of people were lining the road from the town of Sake to the city of Goma, carrying on their backs mattresses and whatever other small possessions they managed to take with them in a flight for their lives. The crush of people was fleeing the advance of M23 rebels, who this week pushed closer towards Goma, a city of about 2 million people, which lies wedged between a volcano, Lake Kivu, and the Rwandan border. Goma is already stretched to the limit. An estimated 500,000 people live in hastily constructed squatter camps scattered around its outskirts. But the latest clashes around Sake have sent another 135,000 people fleeing towards the city, according to estimates from the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. While humanitarians are working to help the displaced, the sheer numbers are overwhelming. Congo is also one of the poorest countries in the world, with over 60% of the population living on less than $2.15 a day, according to the World Bank. On the road to Goma, as the displaced people stream by, soldiers race in the other direction, towards the front. You can hear the whoosh of Grad rockets and the thuds of mortar fire in the air, the sound of the Congolese army and its allies attempting to halt the rebel advance. The M23 rebels are led by Congolese Tutsis, and the group has its roots in former rebellions in eastern Congo. It captured Goma once before, in 2012, before being driven out and going to ground. But the M23 kicked back into life in late 2021 after years of dormancy, and soon after, it launched an offensive that saw it capture large chunks of North Kivu province, of which Goma is the capital. M23 leaders say they are fighting to liberate minorities, such as Congolese Tutsi, from alleged government attacks. But the group is backed by Rwanda, according to the UN Group of Experts on the Congo, and is seen in the capital Kinshasa as a proxy group designed to protect Rwandan interests in a mineral-rich region. The rebels have formidable military capabilities and behave more like a regular army. They have frequently routed the Congolese military after 2 years of on-and-off fighting. This week, however, there was a dramatic escalation in the conflict. The group descended from entrenched positions in the sharp volcanic hills around Sake, about 25 kilometers from Goma. By doing so, they have effectively encircled the city by land. Goma sits on the Congolese-Rwandan frontier and on the shores of Lake Kivu. Apart from a border crossing into Rwanda, the only roads that lead out of the city go north and west. The M23 front line now stretches across both of these roads. Congolese forces and their allies are kettled into a perimeter of several dozen kilometers around Goma. The current fighting is intense, and it features a dizzying array of different armed forces. On the Congolese side, the army is supported by irregular so-called patriotic militias, as well as European private military contractors, Burundian soldiers, and troops from South Africa, Tanzania, and Malawi, who recently deployed as part of a regional military force. UN peacekeepers are also guarding the approach to Goma and have come under regular attack. Together, these forces have not yet been able to stop the M23. With space restricted and the conflict intensifying, neither the M23 nor Congolese forces and their allies appear to be paying much attention to civilians. Artillery is positioned just hundreds of meters from densely packed displacement camps, and more people are dying in the crossfire. At a hospital for war wounded in Goma, run by the International Committee of the Red Cross, worn-out doctors explained one day this week that they had performed 27 operations before noon. They're receiving dozens of people wounded by artillery and gunfire every day. The victims include combatants, as well as civilians fleeing displacement camps. Many arrive at the hospital already dead. Others survive, but with life-altering amputations. Wounded children also turn up at the hospital gates alone, having lost contact with their parents. Harrowing tales are commonplace among the displaced people. In a camp near Goma named Bulengo, people who had recently arrived recounted how they had originally fled to Sake because of a spate of rapes and insecurity in their native village. But then fighting began in Sake itself, and they had to get on the move again. They came to the displacement camp on foot this week. They have little to eat and are now sleeping in tiny tarpaulin huts pitched on a rocky lava field. While they were speaking, artillery rounds boomed overhead every 10 minutes or so. The mounting crisis has sparked unrest elsewhere in Congo. Last week, In Kinshasa, which is over 1,500 kilometers away, protesters attacked UN vehicles as well as foreign diplomats in an outpouring of rage against the perceived helplessness of the international community. Analysts say there is little serious solution to the conflict other than engaging in negotiations. But the Congolese government has vowed to protect every inch of its territory, and it's been investing heavily in its military, including buying Chinese attack drones. It has also secured the military intervention of the 16-nation Southern African Development Community, known as SADC, to fight the rebels. Talks, for the moment, are a long way off. For World Report, this is Emmett Livingstone in Goma, DRC.
Next to Tunisia, where a graffiti artist has had a 2-year sentence for offending the president upheld by the Court of Appeal. A leading Tunisian human rights association says this marks Tunisia's fall into a new era of despotism. Elisia Voltman has more from Tunis.
Arabic calligraphy and graffiti artist Rashid Tamboura has had his appeal against a 2-year jail sentence quashed by Tunisia's Court of Appeal for painting a mural criticising President Kais Saied's stance on black migrants in Tunisia. Tamboura painted the mural last July following the mass expulsion of over 1,500 black migrants, refugees and students into the desert borderlands between Tunisia and Libya. The graffiti in question was a stark black stenciled rendition of an iconic photograph of Tunisia's President Kais Saied staring coldly from a white wall in the southern city of Monastir. Beside his face was a small map of Africa and the words, "Racist vassal, greedy fascist." Tamboura was arrested in his house on July 24th and held in prison until sentencing last December under Article 67 of the Penal Code for committing a heinous act against President Saied. Last week's appeal court hearing upheld the 2-year prison sentence to the dismay of human rights organisations. Tamboura's artwork was in response to the mass expulsion of sub-Saharan Africans into the borderlands between Tunisia and Libya. Beaten and left without water in 50 degrees centigrade, there was an outcry in the international press, but hardly any reporting inside Tunisia. These forced expulsions was the second chapter in a terrifying year for black Africans living or transiting through Tunisia. President Saied's stance on migration gained notoriety last February after he promoted a conspiracy theory that there was an international criminal plot to flood Tunisia with hordes of migrants, claiming that this was changing the demographic of Tunisia from an Arabic culture to an African one. According to Tunisia's fact-checking organisation Falso, online agitators had been fomenting this Great Replacement conspiracy for over 18 months prior, and Saied's speech precipitated an unprecedented wave of racially motivated violence, where black people were dragged from their homes, beaten, and found themselves jobless, homeless, and in danger. Since then, the flow of foreign nationals migrating clandestinely from Tunisia's shores has skyrocketed, as 155,754 people crossed to Italy in small boats in 2023. That's up from 103,846 in 2022. Of those, 2,500 died en route. Last summer, the European Union applied pressure to Tunisia with offers of over €110 million to support the economy if Tunisia would hold back the flows of migrants towards their shores. Migrants are not the only people that Saied and security services have been targeting. Since last February, over 20 politicians and opposition political activists have been jailed. Musicians, journalists and their lawyers have found themselves under investigation, tried in military courts and serving jail time. President Saied, who had seized absolute power in July 2021, sacking the government and freezing the parliament, changed the Tunisian constitution a year later so that he had direct control over the judiciary, which previously had been an independent institution. The Tunisian League of Human Rights said of the Court of Appeal's decision to uphold the 2-year sentence against Tamboura, "This sentence confirms the persistence of President Kais Saied's regime in pursuing policies of silencing voices and cuffing hands. Tunisia is being pushed into the realm of despotism that the Tunisian people fought to break away from." When Tunisians overthrew dictator President Zine Abidine Ben Ali in the revolution of 2011, one of the principal rights they won was the freedom of expression. In the years following, street art and murals in Tunisia blossomed. Back in July 2023, images of Tamboura's mural seemed to be everywhere in the press and social media, including an image of Saied himself visiting the mural. The graffiti was erased, covered in whitewash, And now with Tambora in jail, you struggle to find a single JPEG of the artwork on the internet. For RTE, I'm Alicia Falkman in Tunis, Tunisia.
Finally, we go to Cyprus. It is the most easterly country in the European Union, but situated west of Syria and Lebanon, puts it almost in the Middle East, and its geographic location means it is acutely affected by the Israel-Hamas war, which is contributing to wider tensions in the Middle East. Martina Relihan reports from the capital Nicosia.
Arriving at the airport in Paphos, Cyprus, there's an atmosphere of slight tension. I'm escorted about 20 metres from the airport terminal entrance to wait for a taxi. The area around it is being kept clear of vehicles. My driver explains the system has been in place since the beginning of the Israeli-Palestinian war on October 7th. There's also an enhanced police presence at the airport. NATO has access to the Cypriot Air Force base here, and there was a large contingent of German and Dutch NATO troops in evidence soon after the war began. This little island is a mere 40-minute flight away from Tel Aviv and has close connections with Israeli people. Before October 7th, there were some 10 flights a day from Tel Aviv to Paphos. Israelis took them almost as casually as buses for weekends or just to take advantage of cheaper prices for shopping. After October 7th, this turned off like a tap and was almost immediately reduced to just one a day. And as Cyprus also has a substantial Muslim population, it feels it's walking on eggshells around this conflict. The tension is further heightened by the presence on the island of two British military bases. These were retained by the British following the independence of Cyprus in 1960 and operate as British sovereign territory. They're there with the ostensible aim of protecting Cyprus from attack. Not all Cypriots are buying this line at the moment. The bases have been used in recent weeks as a launch pad for airstrikes targeting Houthi rebels in Yemen, in retaliation for their attacks on cargo ships going through the Red Sea. This has sparked protests outside the gates of RAF Akrotiri in the south of the island, with protesters chanting, "Out with the bases of death." There is also suspicion that the bases are being used by both the UK and the US to send military aid to Israel. And there's an underlying fear that Cyprus could fall victim to retaliatory attacks and be unwittingly dragged into the war. Opinions on the bases do vary, however. A restaurant owner in Paphos tells me he fully supports the recent attacks on the Houthis in Yemen in the interests of protection of a vital shipping route. And he contends that the military bases and the NATO presence at Paphos Airport are vital for the protection of the island. "Who's going to take on the British and NATO in an attack on Cyprus?" he says. The capital, Nicosia, lies about 150 kilometres northeast of Paphos. This small city of about 200,000 people is well used to absorbing the fallout of its neighbours' wars. The 1970s civil war in Lebanon led to an influx of people, many of whom never returned. Similarly with the more recent war in Syria. And it's literally on the fault line of the island's homegrown conflict. Since 1974, when Cyprus was attacked by Turkey, the island has been partitioned, with some 40% of it in Turkish hands. Despite numerous attempts at reunification, Cyprus remains as divided as ever. The line of partition runs through Nicosia itself, leaving it in the unenviable position of being the only partitioned city in Europe. Crossing from one side to the other involves border control and passport checks at both the Cypriot and Turkish checkpoints. Nicosia has quite enough conflict on its plate as it stands, and the war in Gaza is keenly felt here. It's tearing into the social fabric of the city, a local hotel owner tells me. In spite of it all, Nicosia puts a brave face on it for the visitor, presenting as charming, affable and safe. As Nicosia's fine fortifications attest, cycles of attack and defence have been the story of Cyprus for centuries. Romans, Crusaders, Venetians, Ottomans, and from the 19th century, the British, have all made their mark here for good or ill. enthusiasm for the EU, which the country joined in 2004, waxes and wanes and was severely tested during the financial crisis of 2008. Cyprus is the most easterly member of the EU, but it is virtually in the Middle East. It is acutely affected by events in the region. This most strategically located island is really feeling the aftershocks of the war in Gaza and is trying to avoid getting caught in its crosshairs. For World Report, this is Martina Relihan in Nicosia, Cyprus.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.